everyone for coming. And we thank the Wheel Catchers for opening up their beautiful home for this final lecture. And as I have in the past, I want to thank both Ellie Lassen and Pam Lehman for their help in the logistics. We also want to thank our series sponsors. Fortunately, it doesn't look like Golda Shear was able to be here this evening, but we want to thank Golda Shear Aaron and her brother, Dr. Charles Steinberg, for sponsoring the series in memory of the first year site of their father, Dr. Leon Steinberg. His Torah should serve as Eloi for his neshama. His death was unfortunately, like so many in the modern era, sometimes it can be very difficult, and he actually was very important to the family. They were very inspired by his will and his fight to continue living. And certainly this topic, above and beyond the previous two in the series, really is very apropos to the way he lived those final times of his life. And since we have an opportunity now in the presence of her husband, we want to just take this opportunity to thank the graphic designer of our flyers, Toby Klein. We hope that any possible moves will not prevent the help of the internet for your continued help. And we wish you all much hatzlacha in the near future. Okay. Very, very important, sensitive topic to begin this evening with. And I realize that this is going to sound almost trite, but just in a very simple way, I realized how awesome a topic this is, even when I had to just like put a title on the source sheet or in the bulletin. Because everything I thought of had the word death in it. Because that's what we're talking about. And even something as little as that, after all the hours I spent researching, still it kind of only hit me then. So I kind of thought it would be easier if I said the end of life, according to halacha. Obviously, it doesn't make a difference to the one who's in that position. I understand that. But just again, even on a simple level, it gives you a sense of the gravity of this. As I have in the previous two shiurim in this series, for those who are interested, there's plenty of Hebrew literature on this, but for the sake of accessibility, I put down, seven articles, all of which are in English. If you're looking for further reading, and the seven is only a selected sample even of English literature, and there's certainly plenty of Hebrew literature on this all and very important topic. Let me begin with a little bit of a history, as I understand it, even of the medical developments in this field. And this is really obviously a brand new topic. I mentioned even our first class 2 weeks ago and even last week when we spoke about some of the issues of abortion, that even though medical technology has changed the available methods, the basic idea, for example, in that case, of how to terminate a pregnancy, so that was available in antiquity. It was more crude than it is now, but the result was essentially the same. So even though we're talking about changes in medical technology, there was a perspective there. This topic is literally brand new. It didn't exist until the advent of certain medical technologies, the ability to artificially respirate people and keep people alive in a state where perhaps you could distinguish between different otherwise historically synonymous or virtually synonymous indicators of death. I try, not only because of the presentation, but because to really learn these halakhos, you need to know the medical history and the background. But I make no pretensions. I'm speaking, especially when I discuss the medical issues, as a significant layman. When I say significant, I don't just mean because I didn't go to medical school. That would make me a layman. I mean a significant layman because even like 11th grade science was very difficult for me. And I joked in the first class that part of the reason I chose this series, because this is the closest thing I'm ever going to get to becoming a doctor. So I'm going to do my best, but I see at least a few doctors in the audience, and I'm more than happy at any point, not only for help, but even for correction if I misstate something. The basic, the easiest and the best place to start, I think, for understanding this topic and how it emerged on the American and world scene is to start in 1968, for those who don't like this, this was a very terrible date, and for most of the medical and scientific world who certainly accepted this, this was a positive change in the entire medical world, and that was the ad hoc committee of Harvard Medical School, who got together. Again, I'm very much simplifying, but just to give us a sense of how these things developed, and they basically published a paper under the title of The Definition of Irreversible Coma. That title in particular has been picked on by people who are upset at their conclusions, because their conclusions are associated with death, even though the title of the very paper speaks about coma and not death. But the bottom line is they described four criteria which they were proposing should be now considered criteria to determine death. And without getting into the details of what those four criteria are, what was significant, the chiddush of this particular presentation by this committee, was that it did not require a total stoppage of blood circulation. That was the chiddush. In theory, they were proposing the possibility of defining death, even if, for example, someone's heart was still beating. That was a very, very earth-shattering proposal. Skipping ahead a few years, again, I know there were things that were going on in between, but just to give you some of the highlights of this, in 1981, there was a president's commission that was established, which further refined and endorsed essentially this position. It was accepted, again, just to give you a sense of how these things interplay. Obviously, medicine in America cannot be totally divorced from law. So this was particularly also endorsed by the American Bar Association. And there, essentially, again, the conclusion that was reached was that an irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain could be considered, therefore, a definition of death. Again, leaving, again, the possibility, doesn't mean that it would always necessarily happen, or that it would necessarily happen for so long, but leaving open the possibility that you could still have a somewhat functioning, beating heart. You could still presumably declare someone dead even before death. Now, an open point, which is still, to the best of my knowledge, I think, even still not 100% clear, is what, even if you reach this point, you do a test, we'll get to some of these tests in a bit, and you see that this person's brain, or even want to talk about the brain stem, the lower part of the brain is completely non-functioning, and to the best of medical science can tell, irreversibly so. Is that it? Over right then? Or do you have to wait a certain amount of time? Do you have to repeat the test? So even in the little bit that I read, I saw three or four different proposals. You have to do it again, have to wait 24 hours. You should just wait an hour. You should wait 6 hours. And obviously, I didn't do an exhaustive reading list. So I don't know. My impression from the little bit of reading that I did was that, I mean, I imagine that perhaps in given hospitals there might be criteria. But I don't know if there's a universal criteria for determining that. And that, in and of itself, perhaps is a little bit troubling, frankly. But there is this notion. Here, come on in. There's room. I'll move even closer to the door. So we'll even to give you another landmark date, a very important date, because perhaps this was the first time where someone from our world, at least rabbinically, was involved. It could be that there were other Jewish or even Orthodox doctors involved before, and I don't know. But perhaps the earliest date on the American public record, where you had the Rabbanim involved, was the New York State Commission. This was in 1986. There was a commission that was performed to establish this. And one of the most prominent members of that commission was Rabbi J. David Bleich. And the commission concluded in support, again, without getting into the refinements of the different variations and versions of this, but essentially, again, following this now momentum-building feeling in the medical and scientific and even legal communities, accepting this new definition of death. It is certainly worth noting, and we'll come back to him, that this was not a universal decision. I don't know about others, but it's certainly known because he demanded that he have the ability to write a dissent. Rabbi Bleich was a vociferous opponent, and as he is to this day, of that conclusion. So at least the first rub on record, so to speak, that I know of was Rabbi Bleich in this particular context, where, again, in this formal legal context, we'll see other things published by Rabbi Temler even earlier than this, but in this formal legal context, Rabbi Bleich did dissent, but again, he was a relatively minor voice. The momentum in American society certainly by then built very much to a crescendo to accept this new definition of death. Why is this, as I mentioned, I alluded to it before, but let's just clarify, why is this all of a sudden a new topic? Why was this new for the scientific community, and why, therefore, will it be new for the halakhic community to respond to? So the answer, very simply, and not that it's a simple topic, but this part of it may actually be simple, is the following. And that is because before the advent of some of these technologies, it wasn't really a big deal to figure out exactly which function, or the lack thereof, perhaps, was synonymous with death. Because the truth of the matter is that the cessation of spontaneous respiration, the ability to breathe, and or a heartbeat, more or less occurred close enough together that it didn't matter. This minute, that minute, it was essentially one, maybe not a simultaneous event, maybe yes, maybe no, again, I don't know, I'm treading as the layman on this, on thin ice, but it wasn't a big deal. It wouldn't have made a huge difference. Only when we had the ability to artificially separate those two. In other words, you can have, again, breathing, this will be a very important thing as we get into some of the halakhic sources momentarily, breathing is going to be controlled, obviously, by the brain. If you don't have the ability, if the brain can't tell the body to spontaneously breathe, then you're not going to be able to breathe. We now have the ability to separate these functions. You can have a heartbeat, which may still be going. Again, if you had just stopped, if the brain had completely stopped, if there was no breathing, eventually this heart would stop. But now we can artificially respirate a person, which again is not to be at all confused with a heart-lung machine. Again, this is very, very important. Even opponents of brain death would distinguish, of course, between a respirator and a heart-lung machine. A heart-lung machine is doing both, which is why it can only be done for very limited amounts of time. A heart-lung machine is helping the breathing and the heartbeat. That's why it's called a heart-lung machine. Again, from the layman's perspective, I'm sure I'm glossing over many technical differences and other sophisticated issues. But a respirator is just doing that. It's artificially making sure that the person can breathe. So what about the heart? The heart is beating on its own. Of course, if you weren't breathing, eventually the heart would stop. But given the fact that you're artificially still breathing, so then the heart, it doesn't have to be the healthiest heart in the world, but it's still potentially going to function. So this technology has allowed us to separate the two. Someone can have no ability to breathe on their own, at the same time be breathing through the help of this artificial machine, and their heart is still beating. So what used to be more or less one process has now had the ability with, again, the challenge, but certainly a bracha that came with this challenge of medical technology that created this question. How do we determine whether somebody is actually, in fact, what we'll, I guess, colloquially call brain dead? So this is, again, there's the little bit of reading that I did. The best and ideal test is called, let me see if I can get this right, a cerebral angiography, which injects a kind of a dye into large blood vessels, which then feed the brain, and therefore you can see whether blood is still going to the brain. The problem, as I understand it, is that the patient has to be taken to some other part of the hospital to do this. It's not so practical, and therefore, I'm not sure exactly how long or to what extent it was ever used, but eventually techniques were developed that could be done at the bedside, which are more radioisotope techniques where you inject some type of radioactive material. Again, I think in a certain sense, as I understood it, it was a similar phenomenon. Again, it's in the bloodstream. This way you can see if it's going all the way to the brain or not. And essentially you can then, with pretty good medical scientific certainty, establish in many cases that unfortunately this person has no blood flow going to the brain. And then again, for lack of a better term, the brain is dead, and we would call such a person brain dead. So far, everyone with me? Doctors, have I made any glaring mistakes? Minor mistakes, perhaps. We're not glaring mistakes. Okay. Maybe I could have gone to medical school. Maybe I still should. I'm only half joking. There was a... my father, not by trade, but by hobby, is a Moel. And in Cincinnati, where I grew up, there were two Moelim in town. The other one, I just knew him as a doctor. It turns out he had been a Rav in St. Louis. And I think at an age slightly older than me, I think he was closer to 40, he decided he wants to be a doctor. And he went to medical school. But he's very brilliant, so I don't necessarily see that in my future. But you never know. This is more science than I've done in years, just to prepare for some of these shiurim. So with that background in mind, let's see some of the basic sources. And as we had with previous shiurim, again, some of the beauty, the reason why I myself am inspired even to learn these topics, let alone be able to share them with you, is because obviously, especially something like this, where we know by definition this couldn't have been addressed in an explicit, direct way by the Gemara, by the Rambam. It couldn't even have been explicitly addressed by the Chafetz Chaim. Rav Yitzchok HaNesbecker, even people living in the earlier part of the 20th century. So how did the people who were alive, the great Rabbanim, 30 years ago to this day, how did they deal with it? So as we've seen in the previous two lectures, and again, it could be seen in countless parallel shurim of medical or other type of shurim, what we have done is mined basic principles from earlier primary sources and seen how those principles can then be applied. So what I'd like to do here is to first see some of the basic sources. That will just give you a sense of some of the issues that come up. Some of the sources we're going to see now may look like they're potentially in conflict, and that's going to give rise to some of the issues that are debated by the contemporary authorities. And then we'll turn our attention to what is essentially three positions. I'll give you right away. I'll give you the punchline of the whole shiur right now. It's a three-way machlokas. And here you have to understand the significance of this, and I'm sure I'll repeat this at the end. Perhaps more than any other topic that I can imagine in any area of halacha, not only because in the most general sense we're dealing with life and death as its own so touchy of a topic, but here, with perhaps one exception we'll see of a middle position, it's very hard to just say, well, we're not sure, let's be machmir. Right? According to one position, if you would assume the definition of brain death, then let's take a case where someone is on a respirator. Let's say in theory, if we would allow someone to be taken off the respirator. So according to some, you're a murderer. If we don't use the definition of brain death, we have tremendous costs that we pay as families and as a society. Let's backtrack for a moment. What's the motivation? Why was this Harvard committee into this? Why was there such momentum to accept this? There's three reasons. One is a sense of triage and financial, whether it be for the hospital or the family, but especially for the hospital and in the insurance community. To keep someone alive on a respirator is incredibly expensive. Number two is even the anguish of the family. Again, someone who's on this situation for a prolonged period of time. It's a very difficult situation. And third, and perhaps most legitimately, is the issue of transplants. And just to be, again, without venturing too much into the doctor's world, just to be clear, I believe this is still the case. There are many other halachic shilas that come up with other types of transplants. But the specific two that relate to this question, which are so important, are heart and liver transplants, because those organs really can't survive if you have the cessation of the heartbeat. If you have to wait for someone to die because they no longer have a pulse, that the heart is not working anymore, more or less, by definition, the heart, but even the liver, there's a major problem. So the great motivation, if you know anyone who's ever had a heart transplant or a liver transplant, then you correct me if I'm wrong, doctors, but
heart and lung.
Heart and lung? It's not liver anymore?
Liver that will now do post-mortem.
How recent is that?
That is within the last year.
Okay, well, that is certainly beyond my pay grade. Okay, the stuff I read was not what you... Okay, good, I'm happy to hear that. Baruch Hashem, that means less shilas. That's my only... The less shilas, the better. But certainly historically, anyone who had a liver transplant, and even to this day, obviously, a heart transplant. So by definition, you have to understand what this means. By definition, that means that essentially somebody was pulled off a respirator. Is that correct? Okay. So... Again, I'll give you just one little anecdote, but then we'll really hit the sources. This is the following. I don't want to mention the names, although the Rabbanim involved are Rabbanim whose names you'll hear later in the shir. But there was a case a number of years ago, again, it's not the only one of these, unfortunately, where there was in one of the tremendous and terrible murderous bombings in Israel, there was an American student who was in a coma. She was brain dead for, I'm not sure how long they allowed her to stay in that position. But the family, in consultation with one of the Rabbanim, whose names you'll hear shortly, took her off the respirator. And in fact, they harvested many of her organs. I think they ended up saving like 6 or 7 lives. They made big news because even 1 or 2 of the lives were Palestinian. So again, it's big stuff here. I'm not at all making light of the potential upside of something like this. So then, needless to say, there was a funeral. A very close friend of mine was in the car with a different, very significant Talmid Chacham, whose name we'll hear shortly, and he said that the whole time on the way to the funeral, this Rav kept on saying, they killed her. They killed her. And he wasn't referring to the terrorist. So, like, it's like a zero. The stakes are so high. The stakes are so high. How do you know what... Anyway, okay, if you needed any more stories, you know, I don't have any better ones than that. In terms of just, you see how potentially... There's a reason that this has been one of the most emotionally fought out halachic debates of the last part of the 20th century. The stakes are just that high. So let's look at our sources. The primary, most well-known, and most studied source on this topic comes from a Mishnah in Gemara in Maseches Yuma. The Mishnah here tells us of a tragic story. Again, variations of it happen seem almost regularly, especially in other parts of the world where their building code is not exactly what it is in America. Earthquakes, landslides, and buildings are crushed. And what happens? You have people in the buildings. The mission wants to know what happens if this occurs on Shabbos. So the removal of the rubble, etc., is going to involve all sorts of otherwise prohibited activities, malachos on Shabbos. So the Mishnah says it doesn't matter. We still do everything we can to see potentially if we can save somebody's life. Matzu'u chai. If we see somebody, we could hear, you know, somebody's down there, still alive, we keep on going until we can rescue them. The amaze, but if we find bodies that are dead, even though ordinarily we would never want to leave a body in the heap of rubble, Jews, as you know, are very sensitive to kavod hames, etc., etc. Nevertheless, given that Shabbos is on the other end, the Mishnah Paskins, if the people are already dead, it's a tragedy, but then we would leave that until after Shabbos. We only continue working if we can still save lives. So the Gemara, two pages later in analyzing this Mishnah, asks the question, you come across a body and you only see the person's legs. And that's not enough. How do you know just because by seeing the person's legs you don't know if the person's alive or not? So there's more rubble. How much rubble do you have to remove? How much of the body do you have to reveal before you can know for sure that the person is no longer alive? And then we would say stop. That's really the question. In the Mishnah, Gemara quotes a debate. Ad heichan hu bodek. How far do you have to check? The first opinion is ad chotamo, until the person's nose. Obviously, you're going to check for breathing at the nose. Yesh omrim ad libo. Only until the heart. Or perhaps, as some understand it, it means both. It's not enough to just have one. Perhaps you need both. The Gemara, if you look a few lines later, suggests that this perhaps is part of a larger debate. What is the origin of life? Literally, when a baby is formed, what is that first organ? What is the origin of life? The Gemara suggests that there are two opinions for that. Is it breathing? Is it the nose? Or is it the heartbeat? Is it the pulse? Is it the heart? And then the Gemara concludes, no, perhaps that's some interesting theoretical debate that only has to do with development of a fetus. But when it comes to pikuach nefesh, when it comes to saving a life, I feel avashol moda to ikur chayusei ba'apehu. That maybe there everyone agrees that the essence of life, ikr chayusei, is through the nose, meaning it's an issue of breathing. The Siv, how do we know this? A pasuk from Parshas Noach, kol asher nishmas ruach chayim. What is the neshama of chayim? Is breath. And of course the truth is we have many other psukim that indicate that. When Adam is born, how does the Torah describe it? And Hashem breathes the breath of life into him. And here our Gemara says as well, that at least in this context, what is the clear definition? Breath. So it sounds like the main thing we go by is, again, from this discussion, it's a question of breathing. Look at two important Rashis, which we'll come back to. Rashis on this Gemara. How far do you have to check the first Rashi? So Rashi adds something which is not in the Gemara. Because again, until now, we've only seen two potential candidates for indicators of life. Right? Heartbeat and breathing. Rashi interjects on his own a third. Now you might say it was implied in the Gemara, but that's, in a game of stakes this high, there's nothing that's implied is not enough. Rashi explicitly adds a third category. What does Rashi say? First, im dome lemeis she'enu mazi zevaro. He's not moving. And we will see that there are some postmen who add that as an additional criteria. In other words, what if you have spasmic moving? Is that itself an indicator of life? Until now, we would have thought it's irrelevant. But this Rashi may be used as an argument to say, no, it's very relevant. The first thing he says, Rashi, is you have to see if the person's moving or not. If he's not moving, then we have to know, maybe he's too sick, he could be alive but too weak to move. Oh, then let's look at the heart or let's look at the nose. Rashi says the first thing is the person moving or not? Then Rashi says, according to the opinion that we check, even until Chotamo, the nose, then ein chiyas b'chotamo, says Rashi, what seems to be the conclusion, if there's no life in the nose, meaning there's no breathing, she'enu mosi ruach, there's no air coming in and out of the nose, vadai meis. Then we can assume that the person is no longer alive. The Rambam amplifies this in his commentary on the Mishnah. If you look at this next source, the Rambam says, if you're checking and you get to the nose, ba'al matzal on Hashima, you don't find any breath. Also lach for yoser, then you don't dig anymore on Shabbos. Sharehu meis bavadai. He's not breathing. You assume that he is dead. And in fact, in a halakhic context, the Rambam paskins this way. In Hilchos Shabbos, the Rambam discusses this tragic case of the building collapsing. And the Rambam paskins badku ad chotamo. You check until the nose. Ba'al matzal ba'al neshama, Hashima, if you don't see any breath, manichon oso sham. You leave him there, shikvar meis, because then we can be sure that he is already passed on. So, right now, so far, we've had a very consistent theme. If you want to know if a person's living or not, you have to see if they can breathe or not. And if we would just stop here, perhaps we would say without any hesitation that if you have somebody who has this, we got to get back into the technical terms, we only touched on it briefly and I don't want to review the technicalities even to the extent that we mentioned them, but if you have somebody who, again, we colloquially call brain dead, and therefore they are unable to have any spontaneous respiration, which is a medical synonym, so then it would sound like if the person can't breathe, even though it's certainly possible that their heart may still be beating, at least for a little bit, that they would be considered dead. Perhaps if we would stop here, these sources do have that indication. One of the first sources which seems to throw a possible monkey wrench Into that is another comment of the Rambam. This is the Rambam in Hilchos Ovel. Here the Rambam discusses the following halacha. We know there's a category called a goses. Exactly when a person is a goses is not clear. And for doctors who deal with end-of-life questions, this is very important to try to define. Somebody who's on their deathbed, literally in the throes of death. And there are many, many halachas. We have to be so careful because, again, Judaism's appreciation for the sanctity of life is so profound that even if someone who's already a goses, so we're pretty sure it could be a matter of minutes, maybe even in hours, till they're going to pass away, but there's so many halachas about what you can and can't do to the goses because we don't want to hasten that death even a minute or two. If you hasten death even by a minute or two, the halacha considers you a murderer. So it's a very significant halachos in this regard. So in that context, the Rambam says, here in Hilchos Avel, a goses, first of all, he tells you, it doesn't matter how close the person is to death. A little bit alive is 100% alive. There's no... The Rambam says, and therefore, as I say, consequently, if you were to murder a goses, or even to hasten the death, you constitute a murderer. One of the things the Rambam says in this context is, the person has yitzias ha-nefesh. The person, it seems like the person's not breathing anymore, as the Kesef Mishnah understands. And therefore we can say yitzias nefesh, the person has died. And then what do you do? See, right? We see this in the movies, and again, for people who deal with this, it's not a movie, it's a real life. What do? Out of respect, you want to quickly rush to close the person's eyes. Says the Rambam, hires a shofech damim. It's as if you murdered the person. What do you mean you murdered the person? You already had yitzias nefesh. Says Rambam, Eliyisha ma'at. You shouldn't rush so fast to close the eyes. Shema nisalech. Because maybe he's not really dead. Maybe he just fainted. Maybe it's a particularly weak moment. And by you closing the eyes, even that little movement to the body, that really will, unfortunately, cinch the deal. But had you left the person alone, the Rambam says, perhaps it was just a temporary, momentary fainting. He stopped breathing for a little bit. And I'm not sure. We'll see, even in Chazal and in certain tshuvas, but also the stories and legends that are discussed by poskim of people who may not have been breathing for who knows how long, and then somehow recovered. Now, I don't know, even in those days, the poskim said, we're not sure if we can rely on these stories or not. I don't know. Maybe one of the doctors will tell me. Do we know, what is the longest recorded time someone wasn't breathing and recovered? How long is that?
In water?
Yes, so it's children, right? Isn't that just children? Or
underwater.
Yeah, children in water, I think it's in more children, not adults, right?
Can't be an adult.
Right, but children, especially in water, they have this mammalian type of reflex where somehow they can somehow shut down everything that's unnecessary and take oxygen from all sorts of other parts of the body. I think it went up to 45 minutes or something like that, or even longer maybe. Okay, but let's say in something less dramatic than that, without the water case.
Just breathing air?
Yeah, without, if you're lying somewhere and you're not breathing, how long could someone survive medically, would we assume? Anyone want to guess?
I have brain injuries from 4 or 5 minutes, probably. Right.
And how long until you actually would really just...
So you'd be irreversibly dead? 10, 12 minutes?
Okay, so we're not talking about a huge amount of time.
No, it's probably more than that. We should do that in the test. Probably 15.
Okay, that's a nice round number. Okay. So, the point being, says the Rambam, listen, so maybe you'll wait 15 minutes. But if you rush to close the eyes in less than that, maybe he was just not breathing for a minute or two, but he would have come back. And you, by rushing to close the eyes... So, what is significant about this source? It's one of the earliest sources we have, which potentially seems to be in conflict with the Rambam himself, Paskin. The way the Rambam understands the Gemara Masechus Yuma, and others do, it sounds like there we say, no, if you're not breathing, leave the person there, because vadai humes, he's already dead. Now the Rambam says, maybe it's not so vadai. Maybe he's just fainting. Why don't we say, on the Shabbos case, well, just because you see he's not breathing, still keep on digging, because maybe he's really very weak, understandably, a building just collapsed on him. But if you would keep on digging and take him out, maybe, who knows, you do a little mouth-to-mouth, maybe he... These two Rambams, again, I'm not saying there's no potential resolution, but on the surface, these two Rambams seem to be going in opposite directions. Another source, perhaps inspired by this Rambam, perhaps a little bit, which also seems to throw what we have said until now a little bit in the question of how much we can concretely associate lack of breathing and death, comes from a comment of the Rambam. Shulchan Aruch, again, this is a little bit of a segue to last week's year. Shulchan Aruch describes the following tragic case. You have a woman who's in labor, and she passes away. Shemeth ala mashper, she's on the birth stool, she's in labor, and she passes away. Terrible tragedy. So what does the Shulchan Aruch say? You still got to worry. In many cases, the fetus is also, unfortunately, going to pass away too. But maybe you can still save the fetus. So the Shulchan Aruch paskins, not only during the week, But even on Shabbos, even if you have to violate every malacha in the world, you would cut open, you do a cesarean section, emergency C-section, to see if you could save that fetus. Like, that's a psak of the Shulchan Aruch, very pro-life, very pro, you know, we want to do anything we can, even potentially to save this little baby. Fine. Take a look at the Ramah. The Ramah, it's in the second line here. The Ramah says we don't do that anymore. We don't paskin that way. Mashe. Ein nog in afshav kein afilu b'chol, says the Rambam. Even if this was on a Tuesday, and a mother Nebuch tragically passes away during labor, we don't quickly rush in with a scalpel and cut her open, thinking we're saving the baby. Mishum de'ein v'kiin b'mitzas ha'ein. Bekar of kol kach. We need to make this second decision to save the fetus. But says the Ramah, we're not such experts that we can know that moment that she really is irreversibly passed on. And therefore, what's the fear? She's obviously in a precarious situation. You take a scalpel to her stomach, you're going to push her over the edge. Now, if she's already dead, so it's okay. You're just saving the blood. You're just saving the fetus. But what if, reminiscent of our earlier Rambam, what if she's not actually dead? She's just evincing symptoms of death. If we can't be sure, so if the Rambam is worried that closing her eyes is going to kill her, you can only imagine what this is going to do. And therefore, the Rambam says, as much as we care, this is again, I can't repeat last week's lecture, but getting back to topics we discussed more in depth last week, as much as we would care and want to save that little fetus, as long as the fetus is still completely in utero, its life, whatever the status of it is, last week's lecture, but its life, this is undebated in halacha, is secondary to the life of the mother. And therefore, since there's even a small chance that the mother is still alive, and by doing this operation we could end the life of the mother, the Ramah says, now again, I only bring this to your attention, not for all the other topics. There's a lot to say about this Ramah. I'm only bringing it for one point. It's an echo of this Rambam, and that is that apparently it's not a given, right? Based on what we had seen in Yom, we would say, okay, if she's not breathing anymore, we assume she's dead. It's a tragedy, but we want to make sure there's only one tragedy, not two. Let's see if we can save that baby. And now the Ramah says, whoa, hold your horses, not so simple. One final primary source, and then we'll be ready to take a look at some of the contemporary 20th century debate. This is a Mishnah in a Halos. Now, the reason you have to be a gadol to do these topics is because you have to know to connect. If you know just like Shas, like a normal person, you know, like normal people know Shas, right? So if you just have a normal understanding of Shas, so you know, whoa, what topic? Someone dead, not dead. So you know about this story in Yuma, somebody's under. That's like it's an obvious go-to case. You have to be a real gadol to connect the case in Ahalos, because the case in Ahalos is about animals. Nothing to do with human beings. And there, the halakha is not per se about saving life, not saving life. It's a question of tumah, right? A dead animal that has been killed through any way other than shechita imparts a certain type of tumah. It's called a nevela. So how do you know when an animal has passed on in a way that wasn't a halakhically kosher shechita, which obviously would create all sorts of halachos, but nothing to do with life and death? It's a tumah, kashrus, can eat such an animal. So here the Mishnah tells us, what about a case of hutazu rasheyem? If you literally, I hate to be graphic, I apologize, the food is for after the shir for this reason, you decapitated. Someone cut off the head of the animal. A guillotine. Mamish, full decapitation. Says the Mishnah, afal pisha, mefarchasim, even though perhaps there's still movements in the body, the body's still moving. There's no head, but the arms are moving, the legs are moving. Tmeim. It's already, from that moment that there's no head, imparts a ritual tumah, which presumably means we assume that it is dead. Kigon, and the Gemara gives the classic example of the tail of this bug, or whatever the case is there, where you can cut it off, and it could still be moving, even though obviously it's completely disassociated from any, disconnected from any life source. But again, whatever the scientific or medical explanation for this is, we know that there is such a phenomenon, certainly in animals, and we'll see, we know there could be such a phenomenon even in certain cases in humans, where you can have certain post-mortem spasmatic movements. And even though there's movement, the Mishnah seems to establish, if we can be sure that the person is dead, which the Mishnah here at least assumes is if you're decapitated, you're dead. And you think that that's like an obvious thing. Why is that obvious? What if the heart's still moving? The heart's still beating? Obviously you're not breathing. That we can all agree on. You don't have a mouth or a nose, you're certainly not breathing. But what if the heart's still beating? What if your arms are still moving? So it sounds like, at least in this case with the animals, that that is equivalent. I didn't put it on the source sheet, but it's just worth noting that even though it's not in the Mishnah, the Rambam, in Hilchos Tumas Hameis, Paskins, that is the where Moshe Feinstein quotes this Rambam, we'll see, that that is also true when it comes to humans. If a human being would, Rachman al-Islam, be decapitated, I mentioned this morning in Shul, Daniel Pearl, Shem Yom Kodomo, the Jewish journalist for the Wall Street Journal, who a few years ago was taken by terrorists, and basically that's how they killed him, they decapitated him. So in such a case, Rachman al-Islam, these things, even in our barbaric world, do happen. When such a thing would happen, by accident or intentionally, so even though there may still be for some moments afterwards some movement, even of the heart, let alone of other external limbs, we assume that the person is already dead halachically. Okay, any questions? So I said to you that there are three basic positions on the case, again, which is so, so important in our day and age, of the definition of death. Do we accept the Harvard criteria of, again, brain death being considered halachically equivalent to death? The first source, again, there's only so we're going to do a ton tonight, and we're only doing a fraction of the many tons we could do. But to simplify, I want to take the following sources, primarily from one position paper, among many, even by these authors, let alone by others who may agree with them, one particular position paper among two contemporary scholars who are strong advocates. There's almost no one in this topic who's not strong in one direction or the other, for accepting halachically brain death as a definition of death, and this comes from an article that was written by a team of both Dr. Fred Rosner and Rabbi Moshe David Tendler. Rabbi Tendler has written many things on the topic. Dr. Rosner may have some also, but his most well-known piece is this piece that he co-wrote with Rabbi Tendler. So, Rabbi Tendler and Dr. Rosner begin by quoting the first, again, the reason we did the sources until now is because these are the building blocks that everyone else is now going to be arguing about. So what do? Their basic starting point is the way we started. The Talmud in Maseches Yuma, the Rambam, who passes this way in Hilchos Shabbos, even the first Rashi there that we saw, that seems to equate lack of breathing with death. And that is their starting point, which they accept absolutely. That the way they understand that Gemara and that piece of Rambam is that lack of breathing is a criterion for death. Or if you want to put it in halachic terminology, sometimes we look at evidence, we want to know, is that a siba or a simon? Is that just is it a criteria or is it only an indicator? So they understand this Gemara and this Rambam as it is a criteria, it is a siba. If you're not breathing, that means that you're dead. That doesn't indicate that you died some other way. But that is the definition of death. That is how they understand that piece. This back and forth to some of the earlier sources, but ultimately, even they would agree that all of that is potentially debatable one way or the other. Their main point emerges from two or three combinations. It's really ultimately then going to be from one, we'll see. But basically, they hang their hat on a position, as they understand it, of Rav Tendler's father-in-law, more importantly, Rav Moshe Feinstein, known to us as the great-great Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has three written tshuvas that we know about that were published in his responsa Igros Moshe. The dates of the three are 1968, 1970, and 1976. I don't have for you on this page here the earliest one, the 1968 one. But I do have for you the 1970-1976 one. The 1968 one starts off, it's the Moshe's landmark shuva about heart transplants. And it's worth noting there that Moshe says you're a double murderer. When you'll take out the heart of the person who's about to die, you murdered him. And even if somehow you saved him, Moshe thinks you might be violating Ritzicha when you take out the sick heart of the patient you're trying to save. And that shuva, he is radically against any other definition of death, as long as the heart is beating. If you would do anything to that person, certainly taking out that heart, you'd be considered a murderer. In 1970, when he has this second tshuva, he discusses this topic again. And there he repeats, and he makes some very important points. He basically makes the point here, and again, I'm going to paraphrase, but I have it for you here, and certainly underline parts if you want to take a look at what I consider the important parts. Rav Moshe here makes the point that the brain per se is irrelevant. Don't get confused by brain death, says Rav Moshe. The brain per se is irrelevant. It's not the brain. Rather, it's all breathing. It's just that we assume that if the person's brain is not working, they won't be able to breathe. But don't be confused. It's not the brain that's the issue. It's breathing that is the significant factor. Therefore, says Rav Moshe, on the one hand, if you have somebody who doesn't have any brain ability capacities, we assume that they wouldn't be able to breathe. At the same time, Rav Moshe says here, this is in about the middle of the paragraph, where he speaks about electric radiogram.
I think it's electric radiogram.
Right, but that's not how he writes it. Oh. No, so he writes it. This is a quote from the tshuva. I didn't play with it. Yes, I think that's what we call an EKG, correct? I think that's what he's referring to, although in this tshuva he calls it the electric radiogram, in case you were curious how to spell radiogram in Hebrew. So this is how he spells it. And he points out, the one who's sending him the letter wanted to say that if these EKG machines, let's say it picks up some faint heart activity. So even though Rav Moshe has just got through saying that it's all the breathing in the brain, Rav Moshe himself wants to say, but if you still see some indication of some heart movement, you cannot discount that. Moshe is very adamant here again, reiterating this notion, again, similar to that first tshuva, we focused on the heart. Again, here he mentions, even though the ikkar is the breathing, he mentions once again the issue of the electroradiogram, and he says here, I'm going to read one underlined part, Avali demos lezeh hashivas misa, to assume that, in this case, the person is considered dead, lomar da'odom, sh'af sh'roim harofim ali deha electric radiogram, sh'ika tugugos leid, you see there's some movement, some beats of the heart, but and then to still assume that the person is nefshav kemeis, nira l'nestayti sh'ain okay. So here, for a second time now, Rav Moshe does seem to be in the position that we cannot discount the ability of the heart to function. He quotes the Rambam there, and here he wants to say the Rambam did not mean to ignore the heart when the Rambam said everything about breathing. Rather, he says perhaps what the Rambam there meant was that if the person's not breathing, we can assume that the heart's not working. But with medical technology, we can now say, well, even if the person's not breathing, his heart is moving. Perhaps we cannot ignore that. So far, if we stopped here, you should be all very confused. Because I introduced that Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to support Rabbi Tandler's position that brain death is death, and so far he hasn't said that yet. It's good, because the whole world is confused. Because Rav Moshe then has a third tshuva. And the third tshuva, he seems to go back on much of what he said in the first two. It's a huge machlokes how to understand the third tshuva. And again, it's fascinating because you could be having the exact same machlokes in three tshuvas about Hilchos Tefillin. Or two Gemaras, you know, three Rambams. The Rambam changes mind, or you have to read the third one in light of the two. You can imagine this as a very important, but relatively academic debate. The stakes here are just a little bit higher, I dare say, even in the Tefillin. What do you do? You get three tshuvas, perhaps not so. Rav Tendler and many others, even those who are unhappy with Rav Moshe, but almost everyone reads the third tshuva as superseding the first two. That he changed his mind, and he goes, there are some, there's a Dr. Avram Steinberg from Shari Tzedek, who's written, prolific writer, not only as a doctor, but also Talmud Chacham, so he struggles mightily to somehow synthesize the third tshuva with the previous two. But I believe he's more or less a lone voice in this. Because it really are very difficult to put together. Because Rav Moshe introduces new criteria in this third tshuva, which seems to change everything. If you look at this third tshuva, this is from 1976. And here Rav Moshe, in a halachic sense, introduces what could be called, I think in a medical terminology, physiologic decapitation. Namely, we saw from the Mishnah in Ohalos, and I told you that the Rambam talks about this when it comes to human beings as well. If a person has been decapitated, there's no head anymore, person is not alive. Maybe there's some spasmic moving, even the heart. Doesn't matter, you got no head. Says Rav Moshe, this word he doesn't use, but what if you have physiologic decapitation? Namely, there's no blood going to the brain. The brain is dead. Because there's no blood to it. Obviously it can't survive exactly how long it could survive, we just discussed before. But not long. Let's talk about an hour, let alone days or weeks or months. So there's no, the brain is dead. Do you equate that with not having a head? So Rav Moshe here says yes. Take a look inside the tshuva. He starts with this issue of the bedikas hanashima, checking the breath. And then I just want to try to find, he talks about here checking, having a little tissue by the person's nose to see if they're breathing or not. Let's see. So I want to get back to the opening paragraph, but if you turn back, if you look at the end of the second paragraph here, that I have here. Kevan she'asa Omer, Now he's talking to his son-in-law. You told me. Sh'ata, now, ikan nisayon, there's now a test that the doctors can do. Sharobim bidolim yecholim levar al yezrikat ezu lachluchas. Some kind of a dye or something. V'haguk, ayideh agidim. You inject some type of, this is what we discussed before, this radioisotope or something. You inject, you do this procedure where you inject this into the bloodstream through the veins. Leida shenifzak hakesher sheish lahamawach in kol haguk. And you can determine with medical certainty that the brain has been, for all intents and purposes, severed, excuse me, from the rest of the body. There's no more blood going to the brain, so the brain is completely disconnected from the body for all intents and purposes. Right? The brain is already essentially dying. That's the key phrase. That is tantamount to having literally decapitated the person. Or in other words, Moshe accepts physiological decapitation is also a definition of death. So he points out, again, you have to be so sure. Moshe throws in all sorts of safeguards. He thinks doctors sometimes are rushing too quickly to make this assessment. You have to do tests repeatedly over and over again, although it's not exactly sure how many times. But bottom line, the basic thing that comes out of this chiddush is all of a sudden, he says, he doesn't mention anything, but there's nothing to the best of my knowledge. I gave you most of the truth. This is actually, other truths that Moshe wrote are incredibly long. This one's actually relatively short. Although I didn't give it you entirely, I think I gave you almost all of it. Maybe I did give you all of it, I don't remember. But the point is, nowhere in the Shuvah is anything, the word heartbeat's not there. Lave's not there. The Fika's not lave. It doesn't exist. So that's why Rabbi Steinberg said, oh, he just wasn't talking about that. But of course, that's also assumed. In other words, read the third Shuvah in light of the first two. It's the most post-game assumed that that's a stretch. The reason Rabbi Moshe didn't mention it here, because for him, if you reach that state of absolute brain death, and we don't care about the heart anymore, even if the heart's beating, it's still going to be assumed to be death. But Ramosha, in the first paragraph, again, the order of the tshuva is a little bit difficult. I went out of order on purpose. In the first part of the tshuva, Ramosha mentions two things which complicate matters. Number one, Ramosha writes that if you're already on a respirator, it's usher to take the person off. Although he adds, although I'm not sure, I think unfortunately, some of the advances in medical technology with respirators, this might not be still true anymore, which would be a problem. Rav Moshe says, however, let's assume the person is now brain dead. Rav Moshe says, they used to have to come in, let's say, once a day to clean the respirator. So Rav Moshe says, once it's taken out, so Rav Moshe says, tell them not to put it back in right away. And Rav Moshe says, take a test, and he, funny, you told me 15 minutes. Rav Moshe says, 15 minutes. So that's what Talmud quotes it. 15 minutes, you wait and see if the person breathes. If the person doesn't breathe at all on their own for those 15 minutes, then you can just assume the person is passed away. You don't have to then put that back in to see if you can save the person. So I read a little bit that some of the more advanced respirators don't have to be taken out. Is that true? They're not taken out at all?
You still have to change the tubing every week.
Okay, good. I actually heard Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Nechemia Goldberg are of the position, again, not either of them are endorsing this, but in general, when it comes to the respirators, that there's another thing you could do perhaps, which they are making along, and that is that respirators don't just breathe for the person. They breathe better than any person actually could breathe on their own, even if they were healthy. Namely, they breathe more breaths per minute at a higher rate of concentration of oxygen for each breath. So Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, who is Rosh Hashanah or about son-in-law, the great posek and son-in-law in Eretz Yisrael, are of the position that you can turn down the respirator to normal breathing. The way a regular human breathes, in terms of breath per second and the amount of oxygen. And if a person would naturally die that way, they're okay with that. Even though that's assuming their brain is not dead. But the point is, you don't have that, to them, is such excessive means that that might not necessarily be obligated. Even where you would prohibit taking the person off the. But I'm glad to hear that's still true. So if the nurse is anyway going to come in to take the respirator out of the patient, so Rav Moshe says that that's where you can do the test. For Rav Moshe is explicit in the tshuva, you can't actually pull and take the person off the respirator. This comes up, I can imagine, for doctors, but perhaps more senior doctors can avoid these situations. This comes up, I had the Shaila more than once myself in Baltimore, and I was actually once with Rabbi Willie after Shul on a Shabbos when a young female firm resident came over. Residents get the Shaila all the time. Because the doctors send the residents to do this. It's absurd. There's no one who's master to the best of my knowledge. Rav Moshe says explicitly, you can't take a person off a respirator. This is a major shilas for people in the medical profession that can be confronted with these problems. Number two, Rav Moshe has another chiddush, which most people don't talk about, but it's explicit in here. Rav Moshe distinguishes between two types of brain death. What's the cause? All of a sudden, Rav Moshe says it matters. Is this the end of a long, debilitating sickness, or the result of a sudden catastrophic accident? Rav Moshe posits the following original thesis, that his leniency about decapitation, his brain death being equal to decapitation, is only if the person has already been so ravaged and weakened by a long debilitating illness. But if it was a sudden accident, he writes in the words in Hebrew, accident, a car accident, that's Ramosha's example. So then you have to worry, perhaps it's just like a sudden thing, but perhaps it's the function is going to come back. These last two points are seized on by many who disagree with Ramosha. We'll get to those shortly. But let's just take a look. Rav Tendler published a piece for the journal American Medical Association in 1977, where he, again, following as he understands his father-in-law Ramosha's opinion, published this idea. Namely, he writes here that absence of heartbeat or pulse was not considered a significant factor in ascertaining death in any early religious source. As he said, Gemara and Yuma and the Rambam, they all talk about breathing, breathing, breathing. They don't talk about the heart. Therefore, he says, in a situation, I'm skipping to the middle, of decapitation, death can be defined and determined by the decapitated state itself, as recognized in the Talmud and the Code of Laws. Complete destruction of the brain, which includes loss of all integrative, regulatory, and other functions of the brain, can be considered physiological decapitation, and thus a determinant per se of the death of a person. He goes on to make other points, but basically, this is the position of Dr. Rosner and Rabbi Tendler. It should be noted the chief rabbi of Israel officially accepts this as well, accept this position based on their understanding of this third tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, that is the first main and well-known opinion here. There is a middle opinion. The middle opinion is by one of my primary rebbeim, Rav Hershel Schachter. Hershel Schachter and others actually published, as one of the, if you want one convenient place for a number of these articles, I wrote it here on the bibliography. It was one of the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society in spring 1989. So it's not the entire journal, but much of the journal is dedicated to this topic. And there's four or five articles, one of which is by Rav Schachter, which is where I reproduce for you here. And Rav Schachter starts by mentioning the first tshuva of Rav Moshe. Again, it's not surprising, because we already saw there's different impressions in Rav Moshe. And there Rav Schachter makes the following point. I won't read it inside, we don't have the time. But Rav Schachter makes the point, and again, I suspect, although I don't want to say this too crudely, but in a sense maybe he went out of his way to use this as a tshuva because maybe it's a dig at those who want to rely on Rav Moshe for the perspective of brain death and use that that piece of Talmud in the Yuma. Because again, Rabbi Tendler and Dr. Rosner are very clear that they understand Rav Moshe is saying that the Gemara in Yuma meant that, as I said, as I stressed before, that lack of spontaneous respiration equals death. It is a determinant of death. Rav Schachter thinks it's a complete misreading of the Gemara. He points out many people who read the Gemara differently, including Rav Moshe himself. How did he read the Gemara? Didn't the Gemara say if the person's not breathing, the person's dead? No. That's not what the Gemara said. The Gemara said not that that lack of breathing is a determinant of death, rather it is an indicator of death. Not that if you're not breathing, therefore that is what means you're dead. If you're not breathing, presumably that is an indication, a symptom that you have died. But that doesn't mean that it is the definition of death. Again, to put it in halakhic terminology, that lack of breathing is not the siba, but it's only a symptom. It's evidence that you died. That doesn't mean that you died. Or again, Schachter himself uses this terminology. He has an articulate tongue when he wants to use it. He says it's not a determinant of death, it's just an indicator. So then after Schachter, if it's not death, if spontaneous, if the lack of breathing is not the definition of death, what is? So Schachter turns to some Sukkim and Chumash. It's fascinating. There's so much on the topic. This whole body of sources is not once mentioned by Rav Tendler. Obviously, they don't think it's relevant. But the point is, you have a completely different perspective here. Schachter says, perhaps, he quotes a number of psukim, whether it is the case of a murderer, someone who sneaks into your house above Machteres, or the case of the Goel Hadam, you avenge your relative's accidental murder. How does the Torah constantly refer to somebody who's not culpable for their life? Ein lo dam, or ein lo damin. We focus on circulation, on blood flow. Furthermore, Rav Schachter points out that there are a number of halachos which make this equation and further make this point as well. So, for example, the Gemara, when it speaks about bruising, right, the prohibition is a capital crime. If a person would hit one of their parents and cause a bruise, let alone actual bleeding, it's a capital offense. How does the Gemara know this? The Gemara associates bruising, causing some blood, with an earlier part of the pasuk, which talks about killing an animal. So again, you see the concept of causing blood and life or death being equated. Furthermore, the malacha on Shabbos, right? You know, you're not supposed to be picking at your skin or your cuticles. What happens if you start bleeding? You can't floss on Shabbos, if that might mean you're going to bleed. What's the prohibition of bleeding on Shabbos? What is the Yerushalmi call it? It's Yilas Neshama. It's a Malach of Shochet. To cause bleeding. What do you mean? I just have a little blood in my gum. So Shabbos says, you see from all of these sources and many others that he quotes, that circulation, that is the definition of life, and therefore the lack thereof could be the definition of death. So, Shechter has the following ingenious approach. And again, he uses Rav Moshe's chupas themselves. Rav Moshe was asked the following question. If somebody has a paralyzed arm, do they still have to put on tefillin on it? Can they put on tefillin? That's a different question. If they have help. But do they have to? So Rav Moshe assumes that you do, but Rav Moshe says, what about a different case? Let's go first, that's a gangrenous arm. That's one of the fun. What is gangrene if there's no blood? That limb. The limb will die. Rav Moshe is of the position that if you have a gangrenous limb, it's as if the limb is completely dead. And in fact, in the Hilchos Tefillin case, it says you don't have to put on tefillin. Rav Shechter points out that there are other posts who disagree with Rav Moshe. And he says you have essentially the fascinating debate. You have a limb that has no blood supply whatsoever. The limb itself, how do you define it? Rav Moshe holds you look at each limb by itself. So if the limb has no blood, then that limb is, for whatever halakhic relevance it may or may not have, but that limb is halakhically dead. The other posts who disagree hold, if the limb would be severed lying on the table, that's one thing. But as long as the limb is still connected to a larger organism, the person's body, and that body is living and well, then you don't look at limb for limb. You know, this person's not partially dead, partially alive. He is alive. He has a limb that's gangrenous. But that's not Rav Moshe's position. So says Rav Shechter, well, let's think about Rav Moshe. Let's assume that maybe this part of Rav Moshe is correct. So now the question is, if you have not an arm, but a brain, much more important limb, with no blood going to it, would you make the same equation? Does that equal not just death of the limb, which is not relevant for us, but death of the entire body? So here Moshe introduces a new concept. Rav Shechter quotes, the Talmud in a number of places refers to a concept of not all limbs are equal. There are certain limbs which are hanashama tzuyava. Certain limbs which we assume that the whole body is dependent on. It's not clear what those are. The Rambam mentions a number of limbs, one of which is the heart, but one of which is the brain. So the question is, do you need all of these, let's say two or three limbs, to be dead in order to assume that the entire organism, the body, is dead? What if only one of those limbs is dead? Is that an assumption enough to make assume that the whole person has passed away? This, Rav Shechter quotes, is another machlokas. So if you add it up, says Rav Shechter, let's take a look at the next page. I just paraphrased a lot of this outside. But if you look at the last quote here on page 40, says Rav Shechter, on the one hand, he says, in their zeal to prevent doctors from pulling the plug on brain dead patients, some rabbis have declared that such individuals are definitely considered alive, beyond any shadow of a doubt. Based on our analysis, says Rav Shechter, he's not so sure. On the other hand, he says, if you accept the position of Rav Moshe, he's not referring to the Rav Moshe's chuba, it's actually on the topic of brain death. This is Rav Shechter's characteristic brilliance. He's taking a different chuba, a Rav Moshe, that was filling. But if you said that chuba, the gangrenous limb, and you assume that that's dead, that's point number one. And you assume point number two, that the assumption that a second premise that the loss of even one of the vital organs renders the person dead, if you add those two together, it might be possible to argue that a brain dead individual is truly dead. But here comes Rav Shechter's punchline. Since neither of these two premises is by any means certain, it would appear that a person in such an unfortunate circumstance should be considered suffek chai, suffek mase, questionably alive, questionably dead. In a situation of suffek, the proper course to follow seems to be chumrah, to allow the stricter possibility, both regarding the removal of organs, as well as a topic which you might not have thought of, halitza, what if this person never had children? So in this case, that's the irony. Rav Shechter would require chalitza just in case the person's dead, but he would not allow the harvesting of organs in case the person is alive. So for practical purposes, it's in essence completely arguing on Rabbi Tendler and others, but fascinatingly, he's willing to concede that they might be right, although here this is just, from an academic perspective, fascinating, but not lav mitamom, not using the same level of argumentation, but from his own perspective of argumentation, he raises the possibility that maybe they're correct. Now, I know we're running a little bit late, but let's just finish up with the third view. And I dare say, again, without who am I in a topic of such magnitude, but I dare say, for the most part, I think it's an accurate presentation to say that neither two positions that I've mentioned here are the position of most poskim. Sorry, Rav Shechter's is not. Rav Shechter's is unique to him. But it seems like most poskim seem to hold the third position. Again, what individuals should do if they're either anticipating, God forbid, or actually find themselves in a situation like this with a loved one, That's a completely different question. We don't necessarily just add up poskim. You have to have your rov, your posek. I'm not here to make a psak on such shadows. But it is worth noting, you shouldn't walk out of here and have a different impression. I don't think, to the best of my knowledge of the lay of the land, the third position is the one which is more documented and well-established. Many people have written on this. Perhaps the two most passionate was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Chassad of Bracha, as well as, to this very day, he's written probably close to 10, if not more, articles on the topic, Rabbi J. David Bleich, I mentioned already once before. Fascinatingly, Soloveitchik spoke about this a few times, even published. The piece I have for you here from the RJJ Journal, interestingly enough, and I don't know the history for how this thing actually evolved, it was a question and answer, something that he felt like he had been given a survey from the Aguda. Obviously, Bell of the Aguda sent a written questionnaire to Rabbi Soloveitchik, asking him all sorts of questions about where that came from, why. I don't know the history. Rabbi Zubel, Baruch Hashem, is alive and well. We could ask him. I haven't had the opportunity, but it is fascinating. And it's indicated on that letter that and the truth is that if you look at this piece, it's not remotely scholarly to the level you expect Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik typically to be. Because as he points out there, because I already spoke about this at Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and it was written up for a Torah Shabbat article. I tried to get to the two primary sources from Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik facts to me. The facts didn't come through on Friday, so that's why I only have to use this third source. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rabbi Bleich, not that they say exactly the same argumentation, but they do reach the same conclusion, that they don't think that Rav Schechter is even close to being right. Meaning, it's not a doubt. They are as certain as Rav Tendler that Rav Tendler is completely wrong. And to their credit, Dr. Rosner and Rabbi Tendler mentioned that there are people like Rabbi Bleich and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik who disagree with them. But the positions, again, are very, very passionate and very strong. And again, to mention the story I alluded to earlier, the stakes are high, because if you deny brain death, and you pull someone off a respirator, that's a tikkun. It's not like, well, maybe, you know, it's just on my focus. You know, it's not like maybe I put on film, maybe I didn't. This is serious, serious stuff. So we don't have time to go through all of the details of the arguments, but suffice it to say, there's two major points of contention. Number one, how to read the earlier sources, three more major points, excuse me. Number one, and again, especially since these sources are English, I'll leave them for you. You can read them on your own. Number one, how do you understand, as I alluded to before, the Talmud in Maseches Yuma? After all, that talks about breathing. Breathing has to do with the brain. So they, once again, like Rav Schechter here, against Rabbi Tendler, they believe that the Gemara did not mean to say that lack of breathing is the definition of death, rather that it just is a typical indicator of death. Why is the Gemara there in Yuma with the crushed building now because they check the nose for the breathing? So they quote a famous tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi, who says, very simple, the breathing is, again, not the source of life. The Chacham Tzvi says the heart is the source of life. So what's the problem? The heart is not just crushed under the rocks, it's also under the ribcage. Like muscles, a very faint heartbeat is going to be harder to hear and to be indicated than a faint breath if you can get to the nose. So don't just say, well, I uncovered the chest and I don't feel a heartbeat. Maybe there's a heartbeat and you can't feel it. Take off two more rocks, check the nose. Oh, if there's no breathing, then we can assume the heart's not beating. But maybe there is breathing. But again, not because breathing is the definition of life, as Rav Tendler understood the Gemara, says the Chacham Tzvi, and they who both Rabbi Bleich and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik quote this Chacham Tzvi, because the heart, we can be assumed, is still beating, even though you can't feel it. Again, this is before some of the medical technologies that we have, your time of the Talmud, they assume that's number one. That's the first debate. Number two, lost my train of thought. Number two, excuse me, they point out there is a tshuva of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer collects a number of pieces of literature, including the Rashi, which we mentioned at the beginning of the year, speaks about the body not moving. The Chassam Sofer says there's three things that need to occur in order for a person to be dead. The two we've been talking about, and the third. Namely, Chassam Sofer says the person's not breathing, and there's no heartbeat, there's no circulation, and the person's not moving. So these poskim, poskim, like that Chassam Sofer, that you need all of these. It's not just you just have one. And finally, perhaps the most innovative and important piece of the Rav Moshe / Rav Tendler approach, which they acknowledge or Rav Moshe meant, but they vociferously disagree with and deny, is the equation between actual decapitation and physiological decapitation. This is for two reasons. Number one, Rav Aaron and Rav Bleich and others disagree. And again, it's similar to the discussion about the gangrenous limb. Namely, even if you assume that the brain is not getting any blood, but you can't compare, they say, a completely decapitated brain, a head, excuse me, with a head that's still very much attached to a body that seems to be working, not exactly well, but seems to be working if it's still to one that was completely unattached. Moreover, and again, this is really beyond my medical knowledge, Rabbi Blythe, who is a bucky in everything, not just Torah, but especially in medical stuff, Rabbi Blythe points out that the type of tests that we have now do not refer to, as he points out, you'll take a look, I think I reproduced those for you on the sheets, complete brain death. It's something a little bit less than that. Rabbi Blythe actually acknowledges in this particular article that in theory, if you had some of those tests, he'd be willing to consider it. So Rabbi Blythe has a double argument. Number one is he's not sure that it can be equated with actual decapitation. And number two is he says even this radioisotope and these other types of tests, this brainstem death, he still assumes that from a technical perspective, it's insufficient in order to be considered completely brain dead. Again, much, much more to say. I just want to conclude by just summarizing a little bit of what we've seen and I think giving us some important thoughts to take with us. As I mentioned at the opening of this lecture series, the continued addition of medical technologies is one which is by and large an incredible thing. I mentioned an article that I had read that said that the entire body of scientific knowledge that the world possesses doubles every 8 years. If you think of all the information that everyone in the world has now, in 8 years the world will have doubled that amount of knowledge. This is a mind-boggling statistic. So, a lot of things happen in those years. 8 years is a long time in today's day and age. So these changes are happening unbelievably. By and large, our approach, which is not necessarily the approach of every other religion, is to embrace these in general and specifically in the field of medicine. At the same time, as we know, whether it's this issue, the cloning issue, or issues I discussed 2 weeks ago, artificial insemination, these great medical advances present themselves not only as advances, but as halakhic challenges. How to understand them, how to define them, and not everything that is possible should be done. Certainly not for a halakhically sensitive Jew. This is true about many things, but perhaps the climax of all of our discussions in this regard, this is why I picked this as the last topic, is questions literally of life and death. Some of the questions we discussed a week ago or some 2 weeks ago had to do with creating life, potentially terminating potential life. Here we have 100% actual life. In whatever case you're talking about here, if you're having these shilas, you're in the middle of a tragedy. No one asks these shilas in any other time of life. So you're in the middle of a tragedy. It can be sudden, it can be prolonged. Each one of those have their own dimensions, emotionally, and from their emotional, perhaps even halakhically, but certainly emotionally, they have their own dimensions. The issues are so profound. The emotions are so heavy. And the halachos are so significant. That to me, it's just truly remarkable. And again, we're blessed to live in a time where science has created these opportunities. But we have to realize, and I don't know if we always appreciate it, we're blessed to have such talmidei chachamim, such gedolim who can take these type of problems, whatever the conclusions are, but to be able to not only have a mastery, perhaps with help of a son-in-law or a doctor who's a friend, what's the difference? They didn't go to medical school, that's okay. But to have a real appreciation and a mastery of the science and the biology and the physiology, and then to use that to their encyclopedic Torah knowledge, to be able to apply that, whatever the conclusions that are reached. And again, this particular debate has been very heated over the years. You'll note that many of the names I mentioned all happen to be on the back of the Yeshiva University. That, on some level, is a great source of great pride, but it also makes for some very testy moments. And you live in the other end of the world, it's one thing to have a debate. If you have to pass the person in the hall who you think is a murderer, you can imagine it makes things very, very difficult. And I only say that with slight exaggeration. Slight exaggeration, but only slight. This debate had some very, very emotional moments on both sides. Because the stakes are so, so high. But Baruch Hashem, someone who's just a student of theirs, and really in this sense, we're all, because many, many Talmid Chacham have been involved in this, in America and Eretz Yisrael, we just have to realize how blessed we are. What do you do? That is a much more complicated question. But to see the mastery and to see the application of these ancient and traditional sources to such cutting-edge, technical, sensitive topics, to me, is really an incredible thing to behold. I think it's been very worthwhile for me, and I hope for you as well, to study these topics together. It gives us a renewed appreciation for the vitality of the halakhic process and halakha in general, and gives me at least great confidence to know that all the issues that we have before us, as well as the innumerable ones which we can't even imagine, which are bound to come up, Baruch Hashem will be blessed with people, the ones I've mentioned and many others, we'll be able to confront these and do our best to know what exactly the Ratzon Hashem is. And I end certainly on the hope that we often end a funeral on, which is, of course, Bila HaMavas LaNetzach. Many other topics we discuss, we hope will constantly be around. This is a topic which we hope will be very soon irrelevant. We hope in Mirz Hashem for this terrible facet of life to soon be removed. But until that time, we do our best to try to understand what Hashem wants from us. Thank you very much for coming. There are beautiful and delicious looking reception and dessert in the back. Please partake. Thank you very much and have a good night.